On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. B. Allen Wallace expresses his frustration with skeptical critics who are often mistaken about Buddhism and its implications for understanding how our brain works.
This is what bothers me about many of the so-called skeptics. What they're doing is defending the status quo, which doesn't take a whole lot of guts, frankly. They're about as skeptical as Pat Robertson or Billy Graham. They, too, have their congregation behind them. They all agree, and they're skeptical of other religions. They're skeptical of materialism and so forth and so on. I just don't see much difference in the skepticism of a religious fundamentalist than I do the skepticism of a hardcore, committed scientific materialist.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and before we start today's interview, I wanted to make a couple announcements and bring you up to date on a couple of things. First, I wanted to let you know that we've started a forums section for Skeptico, really thanks to Jacob at mindenergy.net, who took it upon himself to say we really need a forum and to set one up and then provide me a link to it, so I really didn't have to do anything. And that was really, really nice of him, and he's paying for the hosting of it and managing it. So that's great. And if you'd like to check it out, or more importantly, if you'd like to participate, you can go to the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com and click on the link to our forums. I also want to let you know that I haven't disappeared, and I do apologize for missing publishing a podcast there. The one that went out last time was really supposed to go out 2 weeks ago, and I just didn't get it out before I got on vacation. And it's just a slip of just forgetfulness is all I can say. But I have a number of interviews already done and completed and kind of in holding pattern to get out. So there's some interesting topics coming up, and you'll see, along with this interview with a Buddhist scholar, Dr. B. Allen Wallace, I have a number of interviews on or with people who have a prominent religious point of view. And I really felt like we were kind of headed in that way anyway, as we talk more and more about the science of consciousness and undermining the notion that our brain is all we really have. It immediately does bring forth the question of religion, and I just wanted to explore that from both an Eastern perspective, since many people, both skeptical and non-skeptical, who have dismissed some of the kind of obvious mythology of Christianity, a lot of times will venture into Eastern mysticism and Eastern thought as a way of maybe resolving or understanding the ultimate spirituality that we might have. I thought this was a great place to start. And then I also have some interesting interviews coming up with some Christian thinkers, if you will, and some surprising, at least on the surface, surprisingly open dialogues about their willingness to look at evidence that could fundamentally undermine a Christian point of view. So all that's coming up, but before we do any of that, we must listen to this very, very interesting exchange that I had with Dr. B. Allen Wallace. So here we go. We're joined today by one of the leading scholars on Tibetan Buddhism in the West. Dr. B. Allen Wallace has received an undergraduate degree from Amherst College and a PhD in religious studies from Stanford. But he also spent 14 years as a Buddhist monk and was ordained by the Dalai Lama. He's authored many popular and very readable books, including his latest, The Attention Revolution, Unlocking the Power of the Focused Mind. Dr. Wallace, welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you. Very, very glad to join you.
Well, great. It's very very enjoyable for me to get a chance to talk to you. I've heard some interviews with you in the past, and I've read excerpts and clips here and essays that you've written, and I've always found it very, very interesting, this intersection of Buddhism and Western thought and modern scientific thought. I think is just a fantastically rich area to explore, at least for me it is. You know, and that's maybe where I wanted to start. I think one of the things that immediately grabs people about your story is that you now are engaged very much in what we all consider a normal Western modernized life. You write books, you do interviews like this, you are very engaged. You were a professor for several years. But you look into your background and you also are someone who spent years in a cave in the Himalayan mountains, the kind of stories that we only hear about, most of us. And maybe you could start by telling us a quick overview of your background and in particular, how you've come to balance those kind of two aspects of your life.
Well, that's a wonderful question and a very large one. So I'll try to be extremely concise in terms of a very long story. But I was raised with two strong influences on my life, which in a way represent the civilization in which I was brought up. And that is, on the one hand, I was raised in a very religious background. My father is actually a Christian theologian. At the same time, from very early on, from the age of 13, I was very committed to pursuing a career in science, specifically in biology. And as I grew into adolescence, then I found these two worldviews, these whole two ways of orienting to reality, to be very different and in some very important ways to be incompatible. And yet I wasn't finding much of a liaison or any kind of bridge work that was being done, nor any completely compelling argument that would entirely repudiate either religion, specifically Christianity, or science. Mm-hmm. And so I just wasn't satisfied to abandon either one of those, which of course many people are quite satisfied to, and nor was I willing to regard them as somehow parallel but non-intersecting and therefore non-intersecting tracks, kind of a non-overlapping magisteria.
Right.
In other words, one well-known scientist. None of these solutions seemed satisfactory to me, and so at the age of 20, then I simply decided to get out of my civilization and try another one. And so the age of 21, then I headed off to Asia and immersed myself in Tibetan Buddhist culture, language, religion, and so forth, really immersing myself in an entirely different civilization, which was outside of this dichotomy and this profound disparity between science and religion, because they don't have words for either one, nor do they have any particular discipline or field that is simply a religion or a science in the Western sense of the term. And so I basically went AWOL on Western civilization for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And then at the age of 34, then went back to Amherst College, finished up my undergraduate degree, both in physics and philosophy of science. And then after 2 years of meditative retreat, then went to Stanford, completed my doctorate there in religious studies. But the disjunction that might be perceived at first glance in terms of the last 30 or 40 years of my life is not actually in reality so strong as appearances might suggest. When I left UC Santa Barbara, for example, where I was teaching for 4 years, I immediately went into a six-month solitary meditation retreat. And just about a month ago, I completed leading a three-month group retreat for 37 people, in which I, too, was meditating 9 hours a day as part of a very, very ambitious scientific study of the effects of meditation called the Shamatha Project. So, in fact, there's been much more integration than simply disjunction, but there's been a good bit of both.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point. And in the email exchanges we've had back and forth in setting up this interview, you did, in fact, tell me, hey, I'm heading out for this retreat, a very lengthy retreat, and I'm going on another retreat. So I think that's a great point. You are still in your life integrating these two worlds. And what's that been like? Is that a smooth integration? And do you find that other people with your dedication to the Buddhist studies are able to do that as easily? Are there any problems in doing that?
Well, it's certainly an enormous challenge. The challenges continue. But it's a type of tension that I find enormously meaningful. It's not only between my meditative practice, my spiritual orientation to reality, and then my whole scientific background and ongoing collaborative research with multiple teams of scientists. It's not only that, but it's also just the kind of the tension between a love of solitude and the cultivation of one's mind, and active engagement with the world and trying to be of service, and also to very much so to learn from others in different disciplines of science, philosophy, and multiple religions. So it is not easy, I don't know of anybody myself, with possible exception of the French monk Matthieu Ricard, who has spent so much time in science, in research, in study, and also in meditation and really immersion in the Buddhist tradition. So there are not a whole lot of people who have spent so much time on both sides of the fence, but it's been extremely interesting, and the challenges continue in a very provocative and enriching way.
Tell us a little bit about that research. What projects are you engaged in right now that you find particularly exciting?
Well, certainly the most ambitious one is the Shamatha Project, and I've been working with a fine team of psychologists and neuroscientists at the University of California, Davis, led by Dr. Clifford Seren. And so we've been working together, planning this for the last 4 years. And this year, the project is coming to fruition, starting in late February, ending in early June. We finished a 3-month residential meditation retreat in the Colorado Rockies. This was for 37 participants and a very, very wide range of behavioral and physiological measures, blood samples, saliva samples, brain scans, that is with EEG. And so very, very multifaceted study, including also a first-person questionnaires, journaling, and then my own assessments of people as I met with them individually once a week, and with everybody collectively, all 37 participants every day for two hours a day. And so I was writing my own accounts of my impressions of people's progress, their development, their experiences in practice. So that's what we call the second person perspective of that of an expert, a relative expert in the field. Then these very, very extensive journal entries. We have over 5,000 journal entries, first person reports, and then these multiple physiological and behavioral measures from a team of scientists, about 4, 5, 6 scientists who are there on site conducting measurements 14 hours a day. And this was with a waitlist control group. This is a second group of 30 participants who flew in 3 times at our expense during this retreat to be measured more or less simultaneously with the meditators. And this control group will have their own retreat, which I'll also lead starting in early September. And so this is truly an integration,
right,
of, I think, very, very significant, very central, and very meaningful meditative practices. And so we were interested in people's first-person experiences and so forth, ways they found it transformative. But then immediately combined with and integrated with these very rigorous, very objective, I think unbiased, scientific measures. Virtually no one on the scientific team was Buddhist. So the vast majority of them were your kind of standard issue secular scientists. And so I think it was quite a remarkable study. So that's one. Very briefly, I've been working with Dr. Paul Ekman, Dr. Margaret Kemeny, and others for now 7 years on another project, much more grounded in society, called Cultivating Emotional Balance. And this was a 45-hour training, including Buddhist meditative practices, but without any references to Buddhist metaphysics or religion as such, integrated with various psychological interventions that had been scientifically tested. And so we ran a pilot study, 2 clinical trials. We completed that about 2 years ago. The data are now analyzed, and papers are being written. And I'm working on various other projects as well, including one that will start up in September at Emory University, that will compare different types of meditative training in terms of the meditative cultivation of compassion and then attention training. And so doing a comparative study of those. So these are just a few. I've worked on quite a number of projects, but these are the three that are most current.
Great. And it's certainly exciting to know that there's that much research going on. I know really in the broader spectrum of psychological research, it's really a drop in the bucket, but it's still exciting to know that there's a variety of different research projects going on. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks, including myself to a certain degree, as I kind of wade into this, on this show, what we'd like to do is kind of strip things away and really look at how the critics sometimes come at these issues and what they think about them. And one of the points that you raise, which is fundamental to all the research that you just described, is the whole idea of what I think you might term as contemplative science. The idea, the even notion that people who examine their thoughts are in this meditative practice can teach us something, or there is some science, or there's some way that we could either even put our arms around this. Do you want to speak for a minute about contemplative science and whether you think that has a place and what place it has in the larger domain of science?
I'd be happy to, sure. I'm very inspired by William James, who's one of my intellectual heroes in this regard and one of the great pioneers, perhaps the foremost pioneer of psychology in research psychology in America. And he, in the late 19th century, envisioned this new scientific discipline for the study of the mind to be three-pronged, or having three approaches. And one of these was to study the mind, mental phenomena and processes indirectly by way of behavior, and that would include interrogation of subjects. And, of course, ever since the time of John Watson and about the end of the first decade of the 20th century, great strides have been made there, and B.F. Skinner and that whole group. So in that regard, William James's vision has been well fulfilled. Behavioral psychology, behaviorism itself has done a great deal of excellent work. And then his second avenue of research that he proposed, thanks to William James, was studying mental phenomena processes once again indirectly by way of studying their neurophysiological correlates, by studying the brain. And especially in the last few decades, enormous strides, as we all know, have been made in that regard. But William James insisted that for the study of mental phenomena, first, foremost, and always, he said, the research should be promoted by way of the actual observation of these mental events, which would have put it in accord with all other branches of natural science. That if you want to study stars, you don't study the brain functions of astronomers or the behavior, but you actually get out your telescope and investigate, observe the appearances of stars, planets, other celestial phenomena directly. That goes for geology, it goes for biology, it goes for chemistry, everywhere, in every branch of science. The primary way of investigation is observing the phenomena you're trying to understand. But what has happened since the rise of behaviorism and the demise of introspectionism in the West is that the actual observation of mental phenomena has been left entirely in the hands of amateurs. Now, this was a problem in the introspectionist movement from about 1875 until 1910. They did take introspection seriously. People like Titchener at Cornell and Wilhelm Wundt in the University of Leipzig in Germany. But what they never got around to doing, and they simply didn't know how to do it, was to train people so that they could rigorously observe mental phenomena and make equally rigorous reports. So basically, the people who were doing the introspection were untrained amateurs, or they were trained in extremely primitive observations. Mm-hmm. And then behaviorism and others, I mean, people in this whole profession saw the serious defects of this approach and basically abandoned it lock, stock, and barrel. Now, in Buddhism and other contemplative traditions, quantitative behavioral studies of the mind, or behavioral correlates of mental phenomena, have never been developed. And likewise, scientific study of the brain has never gotten to first base in any of these, well, frankly, outside of modernity. So Buddhism has nothing really to contribute, or very little to contribute, in terms of understanding brain function or the behavioral correlates of the mind in terms of any kind of quantitative, controlled, experimental fashion. But Buddhism does have a 2,500-year-old history of developing extremely sophisticated and refined means of training the attention, first of all, and then using the attention in introspective manner to observe the origination of mental events, how they are present, how they dissipate, how they causally interact with each other, how they influence behavior, behavior influences mental events. And so this has become, I think, a very, very refined, sophisticated, and highly developed discipline, which Buddhists have been using, as I said, for 2,500 years to try to understand mental phenomena themselves on the basis of direct observation.
Right. So if we can, let me stitch a couple of things that you said together. Okay, so you come at this as a Westerner. You become interested in Buddhism. You go over and immerse yourself in the Buddhist culture, and you find, aha, they have these tremendous insights into our mind, but they don't. They're so immersed in it, they don't have the same a view of things from a scientific perspective. But when you come back and you apply some of the techniques and some of the insights that they have about the mind, what we're finding is that they can be measured and they can be used to inform how we might examine the mind. So there is this whole issue of how we can think about thinking, because I think that's controversial. Some people step back and go, well, the mind can never understand itself. The brain can never understand itself. We can't, all this thinking about thinking isn't going to lead us anywhere. And what I hear you saying is that the Buddhist tradition tells us, no, we can not only think about thinking, but we can actually, in a measurable way, change the way our thinking happens and how it affects even our biology. But maybe that's jumping ahead of the story.
Well, yeah, there's a paraphrase here that is not quite what I meant, and that is when we use the word introspection, it clearly has two different meanings. And one is thinking about ourselves, so introspective thought. And that has its value, but that's not what I was getting at. In fact, we have an immediate perception of our, for example, or an immediate experience that is not thinking about it. It's an immediate experience, just like looking at the color blue or hearing the sound of a race car. We don't just have to think about the sound of a race car. We actually pick it up directly, the taste of food, the fragrance of a rose, and so forth. In a similar fashion, we have an immediate perception or immediate experience of, for example, emotions. Some people have a fairly developed ability for generating mental images. Virtually all of us dream, and some people have the ability of lucid dreaming, that is to be able to actually know that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. And in that case, when you're in the midst of a dream and you know you're dreaming, what you're experiencing there by direct mental perception is the actual contents of the dream, the landscape, the people, your own embodiment in the dream. And so a crucial point here that has been slipped under the radar of the modern mind sciences, to my mind, quite an astonishing degree, is that we have six, not five, modes of perception. And when I speak of the sixth sense, I'm not referring to some occult, esoteric, mystical kind of sense, but simply our direct apprehension of thoughts, emotions, mental images, and so forth that arise in the mind. And so what has been left undeveloped here in the West is taking this basic ability we all have and actually refining it. And that's what Buddhism and other contemplative traditions have done. So what I'm pointing to is a complementarity here between direct modes of observation of mental phenomena and indirect modes of inquiry of mental phenomena by way of behavior and brain.
We haven't talked much about Buddhism as a discipline, as a method, or even the underpinnings of it. And I think that's okay, because there's plenty of that out there where people can explore the whole Buddhist tradition and how and why it's different than some other religious traditions. But because it does kind of occupy that unique area among religions, in that it's very scientific in the way that it postulates some of its ideas, it is open to interpretation, kind of wild interpretation all over the board. And I sent you a clip from a woman who was on our show previously, Dr. Susan Blackmore. And she is quite upfront about her skepticism and about her belief in materialism. And she's also very upfront about being a Buddhist meditator for a long period of time, and kind of sees her meditation practice and as confirmation of this kind of worldview that she has. So I thought we might play that for you and then get some of your thoughts on it.
I think if we're going to have a spiritual path, it's got to be in the context of what we know about the universe. And I would say, yes, we live in a pointless universe. We're here for no reason at all. There isn't a soul. There isn't a spirit. We're not going to live forever in some kind of heaven or something like that. I think what happens in the many, many different branches of Buddhism is that the ideas of a self and a soul and spirit and so on and a reincarnation are so deeply embedded in the cultures into which Buddhism spread that they're the starting point, and they're what people endlessly want to be true. And one of my favorite quotations from the Buddha is, actions do exist and also their consequences, but the person that acts does not. I mean, that seems to me to say it all. Here is the universe in which things happen, but there isn't anybody doing anything.
Okay, Dr. Waltz, were you able to hear that okay?
Very clearly.
Okay.
Well, a very prominent historian, I believe at the Smithsonian Institute, the author of the book, The Discoverers, has commented that the greatest impediment in the whole history of science to progress in science has been not ignorance, but illusions of knowledge. Illusions of knowledge, thinking we already know something that in fact we have only assumed. So Susan Blackmore's words there, I think in many respects, I mean, like time and time again, when one sentence after another, have expressed illusions of knowledge rather than actual knowledge. And so in this regard, I would say her statements are enormous impediments to knowledge rather than expressions of knowledge.
What specifically are you thinking about when you say
she
that?
She said in terms of any spiritual practice, we would start from what we know of reality. And then she goes on to this whole sequence of things she says we know. Well, we know there's no spirit. Define spirit. And how do we know that it doesn't exist? Do we know, for example, and let's go ahead and give an interpretation I think she would not disagree with, the notion that there is some kind of continuity of consciousness beyond this, beyond death. Many people would say, well, if there is such a continuity of individual consciousness, we'll call that spirit, we'll call that soul. And again, that opens a can of worms because it's so open to multiple interpretations. But can we say at this point, let's just take this, death is a good starting point.
Right.
What do we know about what happens to consciousness at death?
Right.
Well, we know that at death, when the brain shuts down, the brain is shutting down, and so therefore neurocorrelates of mental phenomena are almost certainly not taking place because the brain is turning into fertilizer, it's decomposing. But what do we know about the mental phenomena correlated with those brain correlates? What do we know about the nature of the correlation? Do we have any means of objectively determining or measuring the presence of consciousness in anything? In a fetus during the first trimester, for example, or in a person who's comatose or in a vegetative state? The answer is no. Is there any scientific definition of consciousness? The answer is that is agreed upon, generally, like we agree upon the nature of H2O or many, many other scientific notions. The answer is no, there is no consensual definition of consciousness. There's no way of measuring it objectively, so we don't know whether insect-eating plants are consciousness. We don't know whether coral are conscious. We don't really know objectively whether dogs are conscious, although that, I think, should be fairly obvious. And then do we know the necessary and sufficient causes of consciousness? The answer is, once again, we don't know that either. Do you necessarily need a brain or a nervous system to generate consciousness? We don't know. Many people in artificial intelligence are saying, no, you don't need a carbon-based brain. You can have a silicon-based instrument of artificial intelligence. But they don't know either. And so we don't even know what's necessary for the generation of consciousness, whether you need a brain or whether a computer would be sufficient. Nor do we know it's sufficient for the generation of consciousness. And so this is a massive amount of ignorance. And I've just been very clear here, and I don't think any reputable neuroscientist would challenge what I've just said. No definition, no objective measure, and we don't know what the necessary and sufficient causes of consciousness are. If we take that as a starting point, now what can we say, since we know so little about the origins of consciousness in a human being? We don't know when it starts. We don't know whether it's taking place in the first, second, third trimester. We don't know when it ceases. How on earth can then, with confidence, can we say we know anything about what happens to consciousness at death with all of that ignorance? Now, it may very well be that consciousness is solely produced by the brain, but nobody's ever demonstrated that. And so to start off and say any spiritual practice has to take place in terms of what we know, very good. But why don't we be a bit skeptical about what people think they know as opposed to what has actually been demonstrated in a rigorous scientific fashion?
Right, right.
So skepticism, this is what bothers me about many of the so-called skeptics. What they're doing is defending the status quo, which doesn't take a whole lot of guts, frankly. The status quo where so much money, power, and status is of materialism.
Right.
And so no skepticism is required there at all. So when standing up in front with a whole team of scientists but behind one, all agreeing upon the same metaphysical worldview, and then saying, we're skeptics, they're about as skeptical as Pat Robertson or Billy Graham.
Right.
They, too, have their congregation behind them. They all agree, and they're skeptical of other religions. They're skeptical of materialism and so forth and so on. I just don't see much difference in the skepticism of a religious fundamentalist than I do the skepticism of a hardcore, committed scientific materialist.
You know, after starting this show 6 months ago, I think I was more open to the idea that there was something to this kind of skeptical worldview. And the more I've dug into it, there's just no flesh on the bones. There just isn't even anything interesting in the arguments on that side. And I know I'm going to get a ton of just hateful email about that, but I'm telling you, there's just no depth to it. And when you go to the other side and you explore people, you know, I talked to Dr. Raymond Moody, who I'm sure you know and are aware of, but one of the founders of the whole near-death experience research. Skeptical, 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 skeptical will not commit to knowing anything because he's a true scientist. And what he says is, it's too much fun. It's too much fun as a scientist to not know, to not jump to the conclusion. But I did want to come back and talk about another aspect of this Blackmore clip, because I tried to address it in the show, but I'm not a Buddhist. And I'm not that I don't have that experience in the tradition. But it does seem like the second part of her comment would be really an affront to, I think, a lot of Buddhists, but even just a lot of meditators. I mean, I think it's fine for someone to sit down and meditate and say, this is my experience. But when that experience, it seems to me, is just in direct conflict with what thousands of people have experienced and believe over, again, thousands of years, you have to call that out a little bit and say, you know, what is your basis for saying that we can really distance this process from any of these understandings that these meditators have come to? Do you know what I'm driving at there?
I think so, yeah. And what I found here in Susan Blackmore's writings, because I have read her primary book, her big book on consciousness, is when she surveys Western studies of consciousness and so forth, I think it's really quite a laudable effort. When she comes to her presentation of Buddhism, I have to say, rather sadly, it was the worst presentation of Buddhism I've seen in the English language. And I've been studying Buddhism for 37 years now. I'm fluent in Tibetan. I've studied Sanskrit, Buddhist monk for 14 years, and I don't know how many books I've published on the topic. But it was simply uninformed, and it was not only uninformed, which is nice, good straightforward ignorance, but this radical misconstrual and misinterpretation that I think no reputable Buddhist scholar could possibly accept. And so this was really quite discouraging, that, and I find this not infrequent among people who are working in this field. They'll be very professional on one side and completely amateurish on the other. The notion that in Buddhism there is that all notions of a self are refuted, that there are actions, but there are no people. There is no such thing at all as a self or a person. It's just a terribly crude misinterpretation. The Buddha actually stated, I do not say there is no self, nor do I say there is a self. And then we open up to a very, very nuanced investigation of what we mean by the word I or self, and specific types of misconception that are deeply ingrained, that can be refuted experientially through meditative practice, but then reestablishing that on a relative level or conventional level, of course, you and I are having a conversation, and this is meaningful speech.
Right.
And so I must say I'm very, very skeptical of her understanding of Buddhism, and very skeptical of her lack of skepticism regard to the whole metaphysical framework of materialism. And, you know, there's such an enormous leap of faith there that I find virtually no materialist ever acknowledges. And that is the notion that everything that exists must be physical. And the only type of causal interactions that ever take place are physical. What is being expressed here in many, many cases is an astonishing naivete about with respect to the very definition of the category of the physical.
Right.
It has been in motion for the last 400 years. Descartes' notion of the physical was different from Galileo's. Newton's was different from Leibniz's. Niels Bohr's was different from Einstein. The list goes on and on. The very notion, the category of the physical, has been a moving target for the last 400 years. In M theory or superstring theory, 7 out of 11 dimensions have no empirical basis at all, and yet shall we still call them physical? Dark matter, dark energy. We know nothing about them, but we're calling them one is matter, the other is energy. But what we can say is we don't know anything about them. Those are simply name tags to account for, first of all, with dark matter, the fact that the universe didn't simply go into immediate entropy, that in fact inflation was slowed somewhat, and now the universe in its present state is accelerating very rapidly for inexplicable reasons, and so they're going to call that dark energy. But why not just call it dark? That is, why not just put X marks about we don't have a clue?
Right.
But we're going to call them physical anyway. You know, so what we have here is a materialism of the gaps.
Right.
Very comparable to the defensive mode of theologians of a God of the gaps. Anything you can't explain, the theologian may attribute that to God. And these true believers,
right,
devoid of any kind of skepticism whatsoever, when they don't understand anything, They just simply find, they will call it physical no matter what. Take, for example, mental phenomena. When you observe mental phenomena, your own thoughts, your mental images, dreams, and so forth, it's quite apparent through the direct observation of mental phenomena they have no physical attributes. Be in the midst of a lucid dream. Nothing you're experiencing immediately in a dream has any physical attributes. Those are all mental phenomena. Then bring out your instruments of technology, and the whole range of technology then is designed to measure every known type of physical phenomena. There is no instrument of technology that is able to observe or to detect any mental phenomenon at all. And so when you observe mental phenomena, they have no physical attributes. When you try to observe them physically, they're completely invisible. So isn't it simply a leap of faith, blind, unskeptical, dogmatic faith, to say that despite these two facts, that mental phenomena themselves display from first-person observation no physical characteristics, and when they're observed, when you try to observe them physically, you get nothing, they will say, nevertheless, they're still physical. Now, if that's not a leap of faith, I don't know what that is.
it's amazing. You know, in reading some of your writings, and I think you do a very good job of kind of exploring this whole area, how this idea of materialism really hasn't moved forward and hasn't kept pace with what we've come to understand, modern day physics. It's funny because when you move into the whole area of quantum physics, which comes closer to this kind of just hard to explain in the way that we experience reality thing, everyone goes, oh, woo, woo, quantum physics. And it's funny, you don't have to go to quantum physics, as you point out. I mean, the history, the 400-year history. Take Einstein. I mean, E equals mc squared. I mean, what he's saying is that the material is not what we think it is. I mean, we all know E equals mc squared. How can you be a materialist and really understand the origins of that equation, which I think is really first written with M equals whatever it would be, E, you know, but with the idea that mass is convertible into energy, which has been, we all live in a world where we understand that, and yet we want to kind of deny it because it isn't that, it doesn't fit neatly into what we experience through our senses, unless we really contemplate, which is, I think, what your contemplative sciences are all about. It's a, hey, we can go in and we kind of, when I was thinking about your research as you were describing it, one of the aspects of that seems interesting to me, and the work that you've done and that the Dalai Lama has been very open about doing, which is something else that we could and really should talk a little bit about, in that position of openness to science, to using some of these tools that are on the forefront to understand what's going on in the meditator's mind. But if I can slip back to my other point for a minute, and that's this. We've now proven, I think, through, I don't know about your research project, but some of the other research projects I've read about, Dr. Davidson up at the University of Wisconsin and others, that our attention, the attention of a meditator can have an impact on the physiology of the brain. So we study the brains of these meditators, these long-term meditators, and the physiology of their brain is different. Doesn't this also completely destroy the idea of materialism? If we do have this brain that is creating this experience, which is not my understanding of it, but the material conception of it, but we can change that material with our attention and our focus, aren't we in this endless loop of kind of being kind of in this free form, creating our reality on a physical level that we can measure?
Well, Sharon Begley's recent book on neuroplasticity certainly develops this whole theme of the influence of mental experience, thoughts, desires, and so forth on the brain. I think it's a very, very fine piece of science writing. I think demonstrates this to a very large extent. But is this the final, does that spell the end of materialism? And the answer is no, it absolutely does not. I don't see anybody being able to spell the end of materialism any more than 150 years of research and advances in evolution have been able to dispel the belief in the minds of many people that the universe is 7,000 years old, because in a certain book it says so. Uh-huh. And so there are, you know, for the religious fundamentalist, no matter what evidence comes up, they will always interpret it. They cannot help but interpret it in terms of their own preset views of God. Everything has to be understood in terms of their notion of God. And likewise for the materialist, no matter what comes up, neuroplasticity, the effects of meditation on the brain, and so forth. They have a kind of a obsessive-compulsive disorder that they obsessively must find a way to interpret whatever comes up within their materialist paradigm, and then they compulsively cling to that as the only possible interpretation. It is a type of mental imbalance, I think. And so, no, it doesn't spell the end of it. But again, the simple fact is no one has ever demonstrated that mental phenomena are equivalent to brain function. This would be the answer of the materialist, that sure, you meditate, but what's really happening is meditation is nothing more than brain function. And so one part of the brain or one system of brain activity is influencing other systems or parts of the brain. And therefore, everything that Sharon Bakley writes about, all the evidence for neuroplasticity, effects of meditation on the brain, and so forth, all of these are perfectly compatible with the materialistic notion of the mind-brain relationship, because, in fact, the mind-brain are the same thing. Now, nobody's ever demonstrated that, but this is one of the fundamental articles of faith about which the materialistic skeptic has no skepticism at all.
Mm-hmm. Let's back up for a minute, and I want to go back and talk about His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and a lot of people maybe have seen the news items when he shows up at MIT or when he shows up at the University of Wisconsin with some other monks. I think that's a good jumping off point for folks who maybe aren't so familiar with the Buddhist tradition. What is the message behind that research, and why would someone who is such a prominent religious leader be on the forefront of that kind of research into what's going on in meditation and what's going on in particular with these monks that practice in his tradition?
It is very easy from a Western perspective to look upon Buddhism with its monks, its incense, its temples, its prayers, and so forth, and say, that's a religion. It's a bit naive, though, because our very notion in Western civilization, Euro-American, etc., that is including Australia and so forth, Western civilization, is our very notion of religion has been actually defined by the three Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They all come out of the same basin, the same area, and they have defined for us religion, and then in contrast to that, we in the West have defined philosophy and science as separate disciplines. It's enormously important to avoid this whole pitfall of ethnocentricity, to recognize that India is not part of the Mediterranean basin, nor are the spiritual traditions of India coming out of the Abrahamic tradition. So Buddhism from the beginning never conforms in a simple way to the Western constructs of religion. It's never conformed simply to our constructs of science or to philosophy. It is outside of our civilization, and therefore we need to look at it freshly, which is rather difficult to do, but it is a great challenge. And so there are, I want to say this because I think it's very important. If you're looking for dogmatists and fundamentalists, you will find them in Buddhism, as you'll find them in Hinduism, as you'll find them in materialism, in Christianity, Judaism, and so forth. No culture, no discipline, no field of inquiry is free of that, including in politics, Marxism, and so forth and so on. Buddhism from the very beginning has always had highly empirical elements to it, which may be deemed scientific, it's always had very rational elements to it, which are very philosophical in nature, and there's no doubt about it, it has always also had elements of reliance upon authority of other people's insights. Now, not divine authority, but the insights of the Buddha himself and later generations of Buddhist contemplatives. So the Dalai Lama is very much part of this continuum. That is, his approach to Buddhism is not simply religious, although he's a very religious man. He's extremely astute in Buddhist philosophy and can engage in philosophical debate and discourse with philosophers of any sort. But in terms of his own disposition, he's also keenly interested in science and draws out the specifically scientific or quasi-scientific, as in the sense of very experiential elements of Buddhism. And so he sifts through this mass of 2,500 years of theory, practices, discoveries, and speculations of Buddhism, and looks for those elements that lend themselves to very provocative, meaningful interface with modern science. And the mind sciences, of course, are perhaps at the top of the list. But what makes him remarkable as a person who at least appears to be a religious leader, although, as I said, Buddhism is not simply a religion by the Western definition, is that he is willing to put all Buddhist assertions to the test of experience and rational analysis. And he says at any point, if either compelling empirical evidence or very cogent rational argument, or a combination of the two, demonstrates that any Buddhist assertion, including reincarnation or anything else, is false, Then he said, we will. He said, he specifically, I will reject the Buddhist position because a rigorous experience, that is first person, that is observation and experimentation and rational analysis, these trump belief simply in authority. And so this puts him, I think, in a unique position among the spiritual leaders of the world, that he is so scientific, so philosophically astute, and yet he is indeed a very deeply religious person. So I have been a student now for 36 years, and he's a person I'm simply delighted to emulate, because I find his approach so profoundly balanced, his open-mindedness, his willingness to reassess his own assumptions and beliefs, at the same time challenge the uncorroborated beliefs and assumptions of other people in science, philosophy, and so forth. So this is, I think, a very, very fertile perspective to take on this whole interface between science and spirituality.
Very, very good. You know, we've had a wonderful discussion here, and we haven't had much time to talk about your book, The Attention Revolution, Unlocking the Power of the Focused Mind, which I was exploring a little bit on your website and looks very interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about who that book is written for and a little bit about what it goes into?
The Attention Revolution is, at this point, not my last book, but my second to last book. The most recent one is a book published by Columbia University Press last October, and that is Contemplative Science, Where Buddhism and Neuroscience Converge. But The Attention Revolution is the book that immediately preceded that. It's about a bit more than a year old, since it came out in April of last year. And it's really focused about the contemplative refinement of attention and the utilization of attention for exploring the nature of the mind. But above all, it's about the plasticity of attention and the possibility of refining the stability, the coherence, the continuity of attention, and the vividness, the acuity, the brilliance of attention through meditative training. So this was a core theme of the Shamatha Project, the first half of which we just completed, where these 37 participants were meditating 8 to 10 hours a day, refining their attention skills. And I presented this whole type of training, which is this training in samadhi of highly focused, stable attention, as a telescope for the mind. And that is, Galileo revolutionized all of science, that has started the scientific revolution, I think even more so than Copernicus, by devising and then utilizing the telescope to explore celestial phenomena. That is, for centuries before him, we'd had astrologers very interested in celestial phenomena, keenly observing the terrestrial correlates of celestial phenomena, but having only naked eye or amateur kind of observations of the actual heavens themselves. This is the current status for the study of the mind. We're leaving the direct observation of mental phenomena in the hands of amateurs, and the professionals are studying the behavioral and neural correlates. So what we need, as what is needed for astronomy, is a telescope to make extremely rigorous, penetrating, precise, and long-term, that is, enduring, long-exposure type of observations of celestial phenomena, like that which has been done with the Hubble telescope. We need to make similarly rigorous observations of the mind, and samadhi, highly focused, sustained, vivid attention, is a key. So that's the central theme of the Attention Revolution. It lays it out. I think it's addressed to scientists, it's addressed to philosophers, especially those of the mind, and most importantly, people who actually want to do the work themselves, and that is refine their attention, both for understanding the nature of the mind, but also for achieving exceptional levels of mental health and balance. This is one more area where science has made virtually no progress. Yes, an enormous amount of progress of helping people who are mentally ill, bringing them back to normal. But once a person is normal, as mentally healthy as one's own therapist or psychiatrist, then science stops short. I mean, it suffers from an imagination deficit disorder of imagining possibilities of exceptional mental health, exceptional mental balance, and qualities of well-being and human flourishing that are not arising from some stimulus, but actually arising from the very nature of the mind itself when it is sublimely balanced. So that's what the Attention Revolution is about. And the next book, this book, Contemplative Science, then furthers that, saying, all right, if you have such refined attention skills, how can these be used in very explicit ways for exploring the nature of the mind, its relationship with the rest of the universe, and empirically challenging the metaphysical assumptions of scientific materialism?
Great. And I apologize for not following up on that second book. You know, you're such a prolific author, and you really write so wonderfully. It's very accessible, and I find it very engaging. We'll obviously have a link to those books and to your website, which is also very nicely done, that has links to your other writings. You know, there's so many areas we could explore on what you said, and we're running out of time, but I mean, maybe we'll have you back if you have the time sometime, because there's just, it's rich, rich, rich areas to explore. The whole difference between, you've brought up a couple of points, of the experts versus the amateurs, which I think is really something I would love to delve into, and we're not going to have the time, but this whole idea that we can find people who are more accomplished, more expert at looking inside, and maybe we should go and listen to them as at least a launching off point or a guide point into how to look at all these areas. Fantastic stuff. But let me try and wrap it up here. And can you tell us a little bit about the kind of retreats that you lead in general, and just what someone might find if they decided ever to delve into this area of meditation, whether they were to try and participate in a retreat that you're involved with, or just in general wanted to get involved with meditation?
Mm-hmm. Sure, I'd be happy to. I just worked out much of my itinerary for next year. This year is already completely full, especially with the second 3-month retreat for the Shamatha Project coming up in September. But next year, I'll be leading, I think we have now planned 6 1-week retreats in Santa Barbara, sponsored by the Santa Barbara Institute for Consciousness Studies, which I founded and of which I'm the president. And the type of themes, each of these is on a different theme. So one is going to be specifically for clinical psychologists. The other themes are ones taken from the Buddhist tradition, which are very core to the tradition, the training of attention, the utilization of mental perception for rigorously investigating mental phenomena, and so forth, the cultivation of the heart, the cultivation of such qualities as loving kindness and compassion, lucid dreaming and dream yoga, and then meditative probing right into the very nature of consciousness itself. Those are some of the central themes to Buddhism as a whole, and those are the ones I like to emphasize that are both central to the Buddhist tradition. So I'm drawing from very, very deep sources that go back many centuries, experiences that have been corroborated by many, many generations of Buddhist contemplatives. On the one hand, very central to the Buddhist tradition, but also universal in access. That is, one does not need to be holding a Buddhist worldview, believing in reincarnation or Buddha or Nirvana. One can simply be open-minded and eager to investigate these themes experientially, whether one is a materialist, an agnostic, an atheist, or Christian, or a Jew. And so those are the themes I tend to emphasize, and the types of retreats I'll be holding here in Santa Barbara and then elsewhere around the world. These will show up either on my own personal website or for these Santa Barbara Institute-sponsored events on the Santa Barbara Institute website.
Well, very good. And thank you very much for taking the time with us and joining us. It's been a very, very interesting dialogue. So thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on your program.
Well, as you can probably tell, I really enjoyed that dialogue with Dr. Wallace. I found him extremely bright, well-informed on just a variety of issues, and not someone who you can easily pigeonhole as a religious person or certainly as a Buddhist monk. I think he kind of shatters a lot of the preconceived notions that a lot of us would have about someone with that title or someone who spent that much time studying meditation with someone like the Dalai Lama. Very, very interesting guy. And I think it's a good starting point for this discussion we're going to have over the next few weeks of the intersection of science and religion. Thanks to those of you who have emailed me with encouraging comments and suggestions, which are always welcome and much appreciated. Keep those coming as much as you care to. Also, as usual, keep us in mind as you're writing reviews or digging us or just telling your friends about Skeptico. I think it's fun to see a community of people who are like-minded and interested in the same things growing, and to that end, maybe our forums that Jacob over at Mind Energy Net has set up will help in that regard. So if you are interested in this subject, please stay engaged, get other people engaged, and let me hear from you. Okay, bye for now.